The left is having a bad week. It's just not going well for them. You know, I almost feel sorry for them. Almost. I'm not quite there yet. But, you know, this is... Look, let me be specific. I feel sorry for them in the same way that I feel sorry for a four-year-old in the middle of a tantrum. You know, in that sense of, oh, man, you know, this could be so much easier for you if you were just a little bit more mature. There's a better way to live, little dude. We need to get you to figure it out because this is way too much stress. You're putting yourself through a lot more than this particular moment calls for. That's the specific way in which I feel sorry for the left tonight. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Catch us streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. It's great having you with us. Catch up on past shows by doing a search for Closing Argument in your iHeartRadio app. Got a channel there that'll pop up for you. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us this evening. Live and local, Brad Omland taking those calls and producing the show. So, heavy heart today as I'm driving around engaged in my day job and hear the news of yet another shooting. Another mass shooting. And it's been a drip of information throughout the course of the day. Not a lot was known when this first occurred, as one might expect, and the information has been slow to trickle out. However, in the intervening hours between when the news first broke that a shooting had taken place, and now when we're beginning to learn more about who this shooter is and what his motivations most likely were, in those intervening hours, the left, including the mainstream media, has revealed themselves to be absolutely psychotic in terms of their eagerness, their desperation to be able to blame this on conservatives, on Republicans, on Donald Trump. And we've even got, you know, specifically a scenario here with Milo Yiannopoulos, wherein they tried to have this aha moment of, you know, Yiannopoulos is supposedly responsible for inciting this type of violence, when in fact, when you look at the facts, nothing even remotely close to that is true. In fact, if anything, it's the journalists themselves who are responsible for inciting, for the incitement that may have emerged from what Yiannopoulos had said. We'll get into the details of that here shortly, but let's start with just the raw facts from the Baltimore Sun. At least five people were killed and several others were gravely injured in a shooting Thursday afternoon at the Capital Gazette in Anne Arundel County, authorities said. A shooter is in custody, police said. This was a targeted attack on the Capital Gazette, said Anne Arundel County Deputy Police Chief William Crump. This person was prepared today to come in. He was prepared to shoot people. The suspect has been identified. He's a 38-year-old Laurel man with a longstanding dispute with the Capitol, according to law enforcement sources familiar with the investigation. On Thursday evening, federal and local law enforcement officials blocked off the crime scene, or with crime scene tape, the Laurel apartment complex listed as the address for the suspect, whose dispute with the Capitol began in July 2011 when a columnist at the paper covered a criminal harassment claim against him. Now, that is the motivation. This guy had a specific beef with this specific newspaper, and he escalated it to the point of leveling specific threats of what that he was going to come and do this, and then he executed on those threats. He decided to walk into a place, and start murdering people because he was mad at them for things they had done in his mind to him. That was the reason he did it. Now, we've learned those details in the intervening hours between when this news first broke and now, but we didn't know this right away. And during those intervening hours where it was a mystery as to who this guy was, whether he acted alone, what his motivation may or may not have been, the assumption from many in the mainstream media, certainly on Twitter, and Democrats and leftists, the assumption was this is a Trump supporter who has been inflamed by the fake news rhetoric and decided to load a gun and take it to his nearest newspaper and just start randomly killing journalists because journalism is bad, according to Donald Trump. That was the narrative. That was the general narrative until they were able to find something specific to latch onto, and that was right-wing provocateur Milo Yiannopoulos from USA Today. Yiannopoulos recently told at least two news outlets that he wanted vigilantes to start shooting journalists, but he insisted Thursday that he did so to taunt reporters. "I can't wait for vigilante squads to start gunning journalists down on site," the author and agitator told a reporter for the New York Observer over a text message. A text message. Now let's go back and look at this headline here at USA Today. Milo Yiannopoulos called for gunning journalists down on site. You know, somebody needs to explain to me over there at USA Today. Somebody needs to explain to me how one goes about making a public declaration through text message. How do I publicly call for something by texting another individual? Isn't it pretty obvious that that's not incitement to violence, right? Like, now, was Yiannopoulos' text message well-advised? Was it a good idea? Was it smart? No. Is it in any way defensible? Absolutely not. But to try to characterize it, to try to expound upon it, to create the narrative that Milo Yiannopoulos called for, incited to violence, random shooters to go around shooting up newspapers, is a blatant fabrication. One might call it fake news. And indeed, that was the response from Yiannopoulos when he was confronted by reporters about these text messages. The news outlet, which wrote about the incidents this week, that being the New York Observer, was working on a feature story about a New York City restaurant that Yiannopoulos reportedly frequents. Yiannopoulos, when asked to elaborate, told the reporter that this was his standard response, according to the Observer. In other words, he texts reporters this message of, "I can't wait for vigilante squads to start gunning journalists down on site," as a way of trolling them. Now, it's absolutely ridiculous. It's atrocious. He should not be doing that. But that's who he is. He's kind of a scumbag. But there's a difference between being kind of a scumbag, being kind of a jackhole, and being somebody who is actively, publicly out there trying to incite violence against other human beings. Yiannopoulos did not do that. He sent similar messages, this again according to USA Today, to William Sommer, a Daily Beast reporter. On Thursday, a gunman opened fire in an Annapolis, Maryland newsroom, killing five people and injuring several others. Authorities have not said what the motive was or who was being targeted. That's at the time of this writing, which was hours ago. It was 4 hours ago that this article was published. Now we do know what the motive was. Turns out the guy wasn't following Milo Yiannopoulos. But, you know, USA Today just couldn't wait. Couldn't wait to get it out there that, ooh, this conservative provocateur, this commentator who's popular among the right, he's the reason why this happened today.
I wouldn't even call him popular anymore.
No, he's not. I mean, he's it's more accurate to say he's popular amongst the alt-right, which I don't even count as being part of the right, and neither did they. That's why they went to the extent of calling themselves alt, because they're something different. I'll be the first ones to tell you that. But be that as it may, in the popular perception, the mainstream perception, people would categorize him over on the right side. That's why they were so eager to link him to this. What I find interesting is they go with this story trying to blame Yiannopoulos for the shooting today. And they're eager and desperate, you know, even before the Yiannopoulos connection was attempted, eager and desperate to find some way to blame this on Donald Trump, blame it on conservatives, blame it on Republicans. Meanwhile, do you recall, like, the day before last when a sitting Democratic congresswoman told a public crowd at a rally that they ought to engage in harassment, assault, and violence? From the Daily Wire. On Tuesday, CNN political commentator Angela Rae defended Representative Maxine Waters against criticism from Democratic leaders after she made inflammatory remarks over the weekend by suggesting that the Democratic leaders are racist. This is in response to, because Maxine Waters had said, I demand that people stop, or no, that's the comment from Rae. But Maxine Waters had said something to the effect of, when you see these people out there being, you know, cabinet members from the White House, when you see people who you recognize to be Republicans or members of this administration, you need to get a crowd together. You need to get in their face. You need to push back. This was the language that she was using. Get a crowd together and push back? Maxine, you're describing what sounds an awful lot like a lynch mob, something you ought to be kind of sensitive to, you think? And now you're out there inciting, you're out, literally, this is actual incitement, what Maxine Waters did. Media, silent. Crickets. No USA Today piece hours afterwards, you know, calling into question whether or not this is directly related to incidents of violence that have actually taken place against various elected Republicans. Don't care. Don't care at all. And then you had this gal from the, whatever her name was, Rae, Angela Rae, a CNN political commentator who defended Waters and accused anybody who disagrees with her or pushes back against her of being racist. She said, my point is very simple. I demand that people stop requiring Congresswoman Waters to behave in a way, in one way, while everyone else could do something else. Nancy Pelosi says, let's make America beautiful again. Whose America is she talking about? The fact that Chuck Schumer called what a black woman said un-American is problematic, and this is the reason why Democrats have a hard time uniting the base. It has everything to do with the fact that this black woman is intimidating to some people who can't handle the truth. So it's about race. It's not about the fact that the lady said you should get a gang together and physically harass our political opponents. That has nothing to do with it whatsoever. It's because she's black. This is where the Democrats are coming from. This is where the left is coming from. And this is what we have to look forward to going into November, which is good news for Republicans. It's good news for conservatives because the people have had enough of this nonsense. Absolutely had enough of it. They didn't learn their lesson in 2016 that campaigning on, you know, I had to counsel somebody on social media today, some lefty who's all up in arms over that what they call hypocrisy. We're about to get into the whole Supreme Court thing here when we get back on the other side of the break. And, you know, the left has this narrative going of, well, you know, when Merrick Garland was nominated by Barack Obama to replace Anton Scalia, the Republicans argued that we needed to wait until the election for the people to chime in on, you know, the direction things should go. And they held up Garland and then ended up confirming Gorsuch. And so if they're going to be consistent, unless they're going to be hypocrites, then we need to wait until this November's election before moving forward with the confirmation of whoever Trump appoints. And it's a cute, you know, it's a cute little rhetorical argument that they're throwing out there to try to whip up their base. But the bottom line on that is really simple. You lost. Sorry. You know, the reason why the Republicans were able to hold up Merrick Garland is because they won. They won the previous election and they had control of the Senate. He who has control makes the rules. Too bad, so sad. And the Senate is still controlled by Republicans today, under a Republican president. So that's your problem, right? Like, you need to win elections, Democrats. And, you know, you're not going to do so until you abandon this strategy of campaigning on how racist your voters are. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. I understand that it's hard to be a leftist nowadays. This week, this month, recent developments have not been good for the resistance. It's not been going their way in terms of Supreme Court rulings, now the retirement of Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy, and, you know, their efforts to try to tie conservatives to horrible events like the shooting today in Annapolis. It's just not going well for them. They keep throwing spaghetti at the wall and watching it just slide down, nothing sticking. It's tough. I get it. But I'm nonetheless continue to be in awe at the level of hysteria. It's and not just the level, but the nature of it. One of the things, as I go through the reaction to the Kennedy retirement today through the various outlets that have reported on it, the New York Times had a big opinion piece that was just rending robes. And, you know, they actually talked about how we're in dark times, and dark times are ahead because Trump's going to nominate somebody to the Supreme Court. Dark time. What is this? The prelogue to Lord of the Rings? Is this a Star Wars opening crawl? Dark times? You guys are out of your minds. You're just absolutely insane. And what's truly illuminating about the angst that they're all going through right now is the focus of it. The one issue that they're most concerned about when it comes to potentially having a conservative majority on the Supreme Court, and that is abortion. For some reason, the ability of mothers to kill their own children is the most important thing in the world to the progressive left. The ability to end innocent lives on a whim because you don't want the responsibility and are trying to pretend that you don't have control over your own choices. It's amazing that this is the thing that animates them more than anything else. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, 651-989-5855 from Bloomberg. Justice Anthony Kennedy's retirement from the U.S. Supreme Court puts conservatives in striking distance of one of their most cherished goals, overturning the landmark Roe v. Wade abortion's rights ruling. The court's swing vote for the past dozen years, Kennedy sided with his liberal colleagues on gay rights and sometimes on discrimination and the death penalty. His Donald Trump-appointed successor could shift the court to the right on each of those issues. But nowhere will Kennedy's departure be more significant than on the politically explosive issue of abortion. Kennedy was a Roe supporter, and the remaining justices include four who either have backed abortion restrictions or, in all likelihood, would. Abortion could be the central issue in a battle over Trump's nominee in the Senate, where the Republicans' slim majority leaves little room for defections. Because President Trump will nominate the next Supreme Court justice, a woman's constitutional right to access legal abortion is in dire immediate danger, said the president of NARAL Pro-Choice America. Trump vowed during the campaign to appoint pro-life justices who would overturn Roe, which legalized abortion nationwide. His first appointee, Neil Gorsuch, hasn't ruled on the issue directly, but joined the majority this week to block a California law that required anti-abortion pregnancy centers to tell patients how to get government-subsidized abortions. Now, can we just pause to appreciate how absurd it is to regard that ruling as pro-life? That ruling had nothing whatsoever to do with the abortion question. It had everything to do with the First Amendment, with whether or not a state has the right, the legal and moral right, to compel an organization to engage in speech with which it fundamentally disagrees. The answer to that is obviously no, and is completely divorced from what the speech is and who's saying it. It's a question of, you know, should anybody, you know, if you're a Christian church should the state be able to pass a law that says before you bring people in to become members of your church, you have to spend at least half an hour giving them an orientation on the fundamentals of Islam or Judaism or Buddhism or whatever? Of course not. It's utterly ridiculous. And it's, and that's directly analogous to the idea that an anti-abortion pregnancy center needs to spend time telling their patients about government-subsidized abortions. So this isn't even the fact that they took that as, oh, abortion's under threat, abortion's under threat. It tells you that this is not actually about jurisprudence for the left. It's not about the function of the law. It's very specifically about the end. It's not about the means. It's about the end. All they care about is maintaining an end through whatever means that enables a maximum amount of preborn death. That's all they care about. They just want to see as many fetuses as humanly possible discarded into a heartless heap. That's their primary motivation. They don't care how. They don't care what the legal or moral justification for it is. They just want as much death as they can literally pile up. And it's quite disgusting. You know, the Babylon Bee, which is a satire site, a Christian satire site, had a headline, "Liberals horrified at thought of losing legal right to kill 60 million more babies." That's not even satire. And Matt Walsh pointed this out today on social media. That's not even satire. That is literally true. Liberals are horrified at the thought of not being able to legally murder children. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name's Walter Edson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Editorial at the New York Times in response to the retirement of Anthony Kennedy from the Supreme Court, it really demonstrates in bold, clear, uncompromising fashion what the actual mission of the New York Times is, and through extension, what the actual mission of the mainstream news media is. And surprise, surprise, it's not to bring you just the facts, ma'am. It's not to inform the public about the goings-on in the world in an objective, journalistic fashion, reporting the who, what, when, where, and why. It is to affect a political and social agenda. That's why they exist. And the reason why I can say this with confidence is that you would think in an era where they know their credibility is under threat, you know, the president of the United States is engaged in a campaign to portray them as fake news and to undermine credibility, to undermine confidence in the establishment of the media. You would think that if what they were primarily concerned with was combating that, pushing back against that, they would take actions and positions and, you know, establish practices to ensure that they were being as neutral as possible, as objective as possible, and that their primary mission was presenting the news, presenting the actual facts of what's taking place, explaining why it's relevant, reporting other people's opinions, but not interspersing their own. You know, you'd think they would want to establish their brand as one that can be trusted. But instead, they're doubling down on exactly what has prompted Donald Trump and many others to label them as fake news. Closing argument. My name is Walter Edson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Catch us streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and on your iHeartRadio app. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us. Brad Omland takes those calls and produces the show. So the headline from the editorial board of the New York Times is, "Kennedy is gone, now vote." They're explicitly calling for people to go out and vote for Democrats and against Republicans, for progressives and against conservatives, as a response to the retirement of a Supreme Court justice. That's their reaction. Get out and vote. Like, they're just taking the mask completely off and saying, we're for people voting for a particular political party. This is what they had to say. If the last few days hadn't been dispiriting enough for those who believe the Supreme Court could still stand for reproductive freedom, equal rights for all Americans, a check on presidential power, which, you know, they only care about that when the president is Republican, right? A more humane criminal justice system and so much more, Wednesday afternoon brought the coup de grace. Everyone knew it was coming sooner than later, but Justice Anthony Kennedy's retirement, which he announced in a letter released hours after the court had issued its final rulings of the term, is still crushing. It sends a stark message to the tens of millions of Americans who have long turned to the court for the vindication of many of their most cherished rights and protections. Look somewhere else. That place is the ballot box. Show up and vote. In the absence of a Supreme Court majority that will reliably protect human dignity, universal equality, and women's right to control their own bodies, it is up to Americans who cherish these values to elect politicians at every level of government who share them. Justice Kennedy, who was nominated to the court by President Ronald Reagan and confirmed in 1988, defended these values, however imperfectly. He was the last in a line of Republican-appointed justices who moderated some of the reactionary tendencies on the court, which has now had a majority of Republican appointees for nearly half a century. All of those justices were confirmed in the days before ultra-conservative activists hijacked the nomination process and ensured that only faithful right-wing ideologues would get a nod. With Justice Kennedy's departure, the court is very likely to lock in an unmoderated, hard right majority for the rest of most of our lives. Here's the crescendo of their freak out. It is a dark moment in the history of the court and the nation, and it's about to get a lot darker. Once President Trump names his second pick and the Senate confirms that person, you can forget about new or enhanced protections for gays and lesbians, or saving the last shreds of affirmative action at public universities. Long-standing precedents are now at extreme risk. Foremost among these is a woman's right to choose to have an abortion under Roe v. Wade, which was preserved solely on the strength of Justice Kennedy's vote.
They're pulling out the same type of arguments that Bob Carrillo does when talking about Muslims. Well, what about this?
Yeah.
Well, what about that? All of it's at threat because of this one specific thing. That's actually probably not that important in the long run.
So, to put these concerns in other terms, they're afraid that because there's now going to be most likely a 6-3 conservative majority on the Supreme Court, that we are soon going to live in a dark, dark world where people are able to enjoy the freedom of association, where public universities funded by your tax dollars don't engage in racist selection of their students based upon skin color. They're too worried about that, and they're worried that we might actually have, because here's the thing: what happens if Roe v. Wade is overturned? This is a question that I don't really think the left dares to consider. Like, what happens the day after the Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade? Is it going to be like there's going to be Planned Parenthood clinics burning from coast to coast? Their forceps are going to be looted and pillaged. You know, abortion doctors are going to be pulled out of their homes. It's going to be like, you know, the Dark Knight Rises, and we're going to be marching abortion doctors out onto the ice, waiting for them to fall through. Like, that's what's going to happen the day after Roe v. Wade is overthrown? No. What will happen is the several states will start to make their own laws. And God forbid that a woman have to catch a train to California before she can kill her own kid. Mike in Farmington, welcome to the program.
Thanks for taking my call, Walter.
Yeah.
you know, I saw something interesting tonight. I don't know if you may know. I would gather you do know who Mark Levin is.
Yeah, of course.
And there's this obsession over liberal and conservative. I would be happy if we would just get someone that is a constitutionalist, someone that looks at the Constitution in it. In all this hysteria, I don't know that anyone on the left is advocating for, you know, we should defend the Constitution.
They don't care. They don't care. They don't care about the Constitution at all. It is an ends regardless of means prioritization for them. They don't have any, which is why it's so astounding to me that they're so upset about the whole Merrick Garland, Neil Gorsuch tactic of Mitch McConnell changing the rules so that they can confirm Gorsuch with only 51 Republicans in the Senate and, you know, holding up the confirmation of Merrick Garland and all that. I don't understand, like, if they're going to be consistent. It's funny because they're calling Republicans hypocritical for doing that. But if they were going to be consistent, then this would be something that they would be totally on board with, because they are all about, look at what they did with Obamacare. I mean, Nancy Pelosi, you remember that little spiel she gave where she was like, if we can't get it passed, if we can't get it over the fence, we're going to pole vault, we're going to drop in with parachutes, we're going to do whatever we have to do in order to get health care passed. I mean, that was her saying, we don't care how it gets done. It's just going to get done, right? So the idea that they're suddenly parliamentarians over there on the Democratic side of the aisle, they're so concerned about the process and making sure that everything goes the way it's stipulated in the good old Constitution that they care so much about, it's a complete and utter joke. I appreciate your call, Mike. There are a number of people being considered to fill this spot that's being left open by Anthony Kennedy. One of them is Senator Mike Lee, who reportedly is being seriously considered as a potential replacement. That would be absolutely phenomenal, especially considering there's past bad blood between Trump and Lee, but apparently they've mended fences, according to a report at the Daily Wire. And there's also a local potential pick here from Minnesota, a gentleman by the name of David Strauss, who is the 8th Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals judge who was appointed by Donald Trump. And so there's some history there. And he was apparently on the list the last time a nomination was under consideration, which ended up going to Neil Gorsuch. So a lot of potentially interesting and exciting possibilities here. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Establishment Democrats continue to react to the shocking defeat of Congressman Joseph Crowley in a primary. He was defeated by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I'm learning how to pronounce this.
That is the correct pronunciation.
It's I've had to listen to her YouTube videos a couple of times in order to start getting it. After practicing it for maybe a week, it'll start to flow off the tongue. Doesn't help that when she says it, she, like, there's this thing that people do, and it seems to be very particular to the left, where when they say a name, whether it's a proper name of a person or a place, they shift into the inflection and the dialect of the language that the word comes from. So you have to be like, you know, I can't do it, so I can't even demonstrate it, but you can't just say Guatemala. You have to be like Guatemala or whatever, you know, like you have to dress it up in order to demonstrate that you're being properly respectful to the origin. This gal grew up in New York. Like, she's an American. She was born here. She never spent any amount of time living in Puerto Rico. Of course, Puerto Rico is part of the United States. I believe her mother has a background from outside the United States. Her father is Puerto Rican. But the idea that, you know, you have to shift into some other dialect in order to say your own name just to demonstrate how diverse you are is something that I find more than a little pretentious.
Trump does the same thing, though.
How so?
He's done it with, I can't even remember, but he's done it with specific countries.
Sure, sure. Yeah, like I can't think of an example either, but I know what you're talking about. Yeah, I mean it's something that people do, but it's relatively new. Like I don't recall that being a thing 10, 20 years ago.
No.
That people, you know, in the middle of speaking the way they normally do, they suddenly switch accents in order to say a proper name that originates from somewhere else.
I mean, I think that it's somewhat an understanding of the language, or it's supposed to like demonstrate that you know the language. Because even if you, I've listened to Spanish speakers speak in America to relatives who live in America, mm-hmm. and they're basically speaking Spanglish. You mm-hmm. can understand, like, if you just only knew English, you could still understand half of what they were saying because they're talking about American things in America. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a melting pot symbol that people want to still identify with, that like this is how I pronounce it in if I was in a Spanish-speaking country, right. So this is how I'm going to pronounce it now.
Right.
It's kind
except,
of that.
Except you're not in a Spanish-speaking country, and the idea, because what it conveys is the expectation that when I say your name, I'm going to do that, and I'm not.
I mean, I've still heard it both ways. Like, I've pronounced people's names in the Army, and they're like, just say it this way. It's like, oh, okay, I'll say it the American way then.
Yeah, I'm not gonna shift my whole speech pattern just to say your name. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's like I say, a little pretentious. But Democrats are reacting to this. Liberal Democrats on Wednesday set a string of victories in U.S. nominating contests, notably the surprise toppling of powerful Congressman Joseph Crowley in New York, proved that the party must embrace progressive priorities or face defeat. But ahead of the November midterm elections and the 2020 presidential race, questions remain about whether the wins signal a permanent leftward shift for the party or resulted from specific factors in those races. The best way to excite voters and maximize a wave in 2018 is to run bold, progressive, younger, more diverse candidates who connect authentically with the economic realities of voters, not old school candidates running establishment campaigns or who are fueled by corporate money, the Progressive Change Campaign Committee said in a statement, calling the elections a battle for the heart and soul of the Democratic Party. Now, that statement there, that take on what took place on Tuesday, to me, is demonstrative of this phenomenon that takes place in politics where people try to project their desired interpretation as the definitive interpretation. You know, like, obviously, the Progressive Change Campaign Committee wants to see a world where political victory is fueled by embracing candidates who they most agree with. But the fact of the matter is, you know, as we talked about at some length yesterday, this district is not like every other district in New York or in the country. And, you know, the notion that a gal who is 28 years old, has no political experience, and is running on a federal jobs guarantee and Medicare for all and pure socialism and as a member of the Democratic Socialist Society, the idea that she's going to win in, say, Minnesota's CD2, right? Like, if this gal was running against Jason Lewis, she would be utterly and completely trounced. It would be like 60-40 at a minimum. And the Democrats, the real Democrats, the smart ones who aren't spouting off on social media and who are actually in the smoky back rooms making decisions about where to put their money, know that. And so, interesting, you know, speaking of socialism and the direction that Ocasio Cortez wants to take us, Venezuela has an interesting situation taking place with hyperinflation. A cup of coffee now costs 1 million bolivars in Caracas. I can't pronounce anything tonight.
Caracas?
Caracas. It's an astounding sum of money, this from Bloomberg. Consider that just 2 years ago, when we launched the Bloomberg Cafe Con Leche Index, a coffee cost 450 bolivars, or what today's price is the equivalent of almost one-fifth of the monthly minimum wage. One-fifth of the monthly minimum wage for a cup of coffee, and that's what it was compared to what it is now. 450 and now it's 1 million. So for all intents and purposes, this currency is completely and utterly worthless. I mean, it was worthless back when they started looking at it. It's all completely worthless now. And that's the direction that Cortez and others of her stripe would ultimately take us. You know, is this place where the ability of individuals to pursue their own values and through that pursuit engage with others peacefully in consensual trade, seeking the highest value for the lowest cost. You know, that is a process that results in unbridled productivity and the miracle of something like the supermarket. You know, I breezed through during one of the breaks here, breezed past an article at Intellectual Takeout. It was a gal who grew up in a communist nation reflecting upon what it was like when she was young there compared to what it's like here in the United States of America. And she talked about her mother having to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning in order to make it to the grocery store before they opened at 6 a.m. in order to get in there for a rare occasion to actually be able to buy things like bread and milk and butter. We don't have to worry about that here because of the relative freedom that we enjoy. And the idea that that's something that's called into question and the policies embraced by a country like Venezuela are considered serious by Democrats is pretty pathetic. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. Catch us streaming, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. We are here 9 to 11 weeknights. Appreciate you joining us. You can take it a step further. Give us a call, 651-989-5855. Become part of the program. Brad Ullman takes those calls and produces the show. From the Daily Wire, the Republican National Committee released a brutal campaign ad on Tuesday attacking the political left ahead of the 2018 midterms, highlighting their extreme rhetoric and actions. The ad comes after Representative Maxine Waters called for the harassment of members of the Trump administration on Saturday. Various members of the Trump administration have already been targeted in recent days, including White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders, DHS Secretary Christian Nielsen, and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Voters have a clear choice in 2018. The Democrat Party is the party of obstruction and extreme rhetoric, while the Republican Party is working to deliver a stronger economy for all Americans, said RNC spokesman Steve Guest, speaking to the Daily Wire. The ad highlights multiple well-publicized instances of those on the political left advocating for extreme action in response to the Trump administration, including Madonna saying she has thought about blowing up the White House, Snoop Dogg shooting the president in a music video, Bill Maher saying he hopes the economy crashes so it hurts Trump, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi saying she doesn't know why there aren't uprisings all over the country. That one is just absolutely damning. And Waters' extreme speech where she called for the harassment of Trump cabinet members. In contrast with the political left's message, the RNC highlights the accomplishments of the Trump administration through the administration's first 500 days in office. This is the winning strategy. Absolutely, 100%. This is the winning strategy. This is why Donald Trump is the president. And look, you know, you can credit Trump with all sorts of genius. You can credit him with being a masterful leader, a great negotiator, a deal maker, what have you. Regardless of the veracity of those claims, Trump won in no small part because of how horrible the left is. And that was personified in Hillary Clinton. Like, Hillary Clinton is kind of like the manifestation, the conjured monster visage of everything that the left represents. Like, the visual representation of it is Hillary Clinton. But it's more than just her, right? It's as indicated by all of these examples that are cited in this RNC ad. This is where the left lives. And again, going back to, you know, we started the show tonight, talking about the shooting in Maryland today and how, on the one hand, in the hour since the news of that shooting broke, between when we first knew a shooting had occurred and when we finally started to get the trickle of who this shooter is and what his motivations were, which, as it turns out, were non-political and personal. He had a personal grudge against this newspaper. In those intervening hours, the left was tripping over themselves to conjure some connection or some rationale by which they could blame Donald Trump, Republicans, and conservatives for this violence, which in and of itself is ridiculously hypocritical for a couple of reasons. One, because folks on their side, prominent folks, the House Minority Leader, Nancy Pelosi, right? Bill Maher, their celebrity spokespeople, Madonna, Snoop Dogg, what have you, have openly called for actual violence on a routine basis. It's like, it's just where they live. It's just what they believe, right? Like, that's one reason why it's hypocritical. But there's something deeper. There's something more fundamental that reveals this concern over violence to be hypocritical. And that's the fact that the left's worldview, their fundamental underlying ideology, is a call for violence. That's what progressivism is. Progressivism is incitement to violence. It's state violence, but it's nonetheless violence. They want a world. They want to craft a world through public policy whereby your rights are routinely and systemically violated every single day, where you are capped, you are controlled, you are restrained, you are mandated, you are restricted, you are regulated, you are owned by them. You can act only with their permission. You build and you create only to satisfy their whims and to meet the ends that they set. They want to own you. And if you step out of line, they want to harm you physically. And that's why you see Madonna saying she wants to blow up the White House and Snoop Dogg, you know, portraying himself shooting the president in a music video. And Nancy Pelosi saying she's surprised there aren't uprisings all over the country. These aren't aberrations. These are natural rhetorical outgrowths of what they believe deep down in the depths of their hearts and souls. They are violent people with a violent ideology that employs violent means to achieve violent ends. That's who they are. And so a successful political strategy going into 2018 is to just contrast that. Just contrast that against making America great again. Contrast that against believing in the decency and productivity of the American citizen and the American economy and the American culture. Contrast the left telling us how horrible we are because we're Americans, how horrible white people are because they're white, how horrible men are because they're men. Contrast that against a belief that each individual, regardless of their background, regardless of their gender, regardless of their racial identity, has the potential to be whatever they are capable of becoming under the glorious condition of liberty, protected by a government that is entrusted to people who are worthy of pursuing that end and who believe in the American people. This is an easy win. It's extraordinarily easy. It's a strategy that is dependent upon the left continuing to be the left, which they will. They will be. They will continue to engage in this type of rhetoric. They will continue to call for violence. They will continue to engage in violence. They will continue to put out fake news like they did today in the aftermath of the shooting, trying to blame it on Milo Yiannopoulos, trying to draw connections to Donald Trump. They're going to continue to do that. They're going to continue to double down. So the playbook here is really simple, really easy. And it's good to see that the RNC is taking that play and running with it. So let's talk a little bit about tariffs, shall we? A couple of stories from this week that demonstrate the truth of my position on this economic issue. One comes to us from CNBC. Automaker Toyota said in a statement on Wednesday that a 25% tariff on automobiles would increase the cost of every vehicle sold in the United States. In May, President Donald Trump directed the Commerce Department to investigate whether car imports were a threat to national security. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross has said the investigation would be completed later in the summer, possibly as soon as July. 137,000 Americans support their families working for Toyota and Toyota and Lexus dealerships, the company said in the statement. They are not a national security threat. Indeed, Toyota operates 10 manufacturing plants in the U.S. We are an exemplar of the manufacturing might of America. Now, that is a solid, solid point.
But I thought the tariffs were supposed to be good for America.
I mean, what? You know, it's funny because we've had pro-tariff callers in the show who have even acknowledged this. The fact that
every one of them.
There is no Chinese company. There is no American company. There is no Japanese company. There are only companies that happen to be based in different countries, but they source their labor and their supplies and channel their logistics through vendors from all over the world. And the reason they do so is because they're seeking the highest value at the lowest cost. Now, I specifically want to talk to those of you out there who have a Toyota. We used to. I think my wife's last vehicle was a Toyota. Why? Why do you? Is it because you're un-American? You don't believe in America? Are you a communist? Are you a slaver? Are you with the Chinese? Are you an agent of Xi Jinping? Which doesn't even make sense because Toyota is Japanese, isn't it? Conflating Japanese and Chinese. It's all the same. It's not American, that's for sure. How dare you? Why do you own a Toyota? Every Toyota you see out there on the street, what a betrayal of the American worker. Right? Now, in honesty, when you're honest with yourself, isn't it pretty obvious that you're not thinking about any of that? When you decide to make your purchase of an automobile, you're only thinking about one thing. Most people, normal people, are only thinking about one thing when they go to purchase an automobile or any other product and service. Am I getting the best deal? Am I getting what I want for a price that I agree to? Am I coming out of this thing better off than I was before I went into it? That's the question that you consider when you engage in an economic transaction. And the effect of a tariff is to tell you that's not good enough. That consideration of value and price is not good enough. Because the purchase isn't actually about you, didn't you know, when you go to buy a car. It's not about you. It's about some other guy in some other state who might lose his job because his company can't make cars as well as Toyota can. So, you know, I don't understand. You know, there's the other story here. Largest U.S. nail manufacturer. This comes from CNN Money. Largest U.S. nail manufacturer on the brink of extinction because of the steel tariffs. Now, I thought the whole point of these tariffs was to save American jobs. I thought the whole point was to make America great again. Turns out that in order to give one guy his job, you know, in a nickel mine up on the Iron Range, in order to give him his job, we're going to have to take away a bunch of other people's jobs making nails somewhere else in the U.S. Is that fair? Is that right? Is that making America great again? No. It's wrong. It's immoral. It's improper. It's a destruction of economic value. And, you know, it's real easy from a political perspective to march out the beneficiaries of the tariff and be like, oh, look at these jobs that we saved. Look at these factories that we reopened because we put our thumb on the scale of economic consideration of price. But what's not going to be featured on that stage is all of the consequences, all of the effects elsewhere in the economy. the plants that close, the jobs that are lost, the companies that never even get off the ground because the economic context no longer fits their business model. Invisible losses that are nonetheless real. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name's Walter Edson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Minneapolis and St. Paul are apparently in an ongoing competition to see who can become Venezuela the quickest. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, 651-989-5855, the number to join us. From the Star Tribune, St. Paul leaders say they're still deciding the details of a proposed citywide minimum wage. But one big detail appears to be settled. St. Paul will have a $15 minimum wage. The momentum comes from Mayor Melvin Carter, who said at a recent community listening session on the minimum wage that 15 is just the headline and the specifics still need to be figured out. Well, that's good. That's good. That's good. It's, you know, so they, I mean, isn't that basically an admission that is totally arbitrary? Yeah, we don't know how we're going to do it or how it's going to work or why. We can't get into any sort of justification for it because we haven't really thought that hard about it. But the number's going to be 15. Continuing with the Star Tribune. At the same time, activist groups are organizing rallies and flooding city meetings to push for a $15 minimum wage without exemptions. Everybody's pretty sure that $15 is going to pass, said Fernando Nunez, communications director for Centro. I can't even pronounce that. One of the groups pushing for a wage hike in St. Paul. The Nonpartisan Citizens League, which the St. Paul Foundation brought on to study the potential effects of a citywide minimum wage, has convened a committee to discuss what a minimum wage should be, if any exemptions should be made, how tipped workers will be affected, and how the increase should be phased in. They're expected to make recommendations to the city by the end of the summer. The committee could recommend an hourly wage other than 15, but it's unlikely, said B. Kyle, committee co-chair and president and CEO of the St. Paul Area Chamber of Commerce. Meanwhile, listening sessions this summer will give members of the public an opportunity to learn about the minimum wage and share their opinions. Opponents of a municipal minimum wage say at this point they don't expect public input to make much of a difference. The mayor has come out and said, we're going to $15, period, said Cam Winton, director of labor management policy for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, which has fought the Minneapolis wage ordinance. Why would anyone think there's a genuine conversation to have when leadership has already said we're going to $15? If the city council passes a minimum wage ordinance this year, St. Paul will join Minneapolis and cities across the country, including San Francisco, Seattle, and New York, that have done the same. Well, won't that just be special? Won't we have something to be proud of? We're just like San Francisco here in the land of 10,000 lakes.
The city in which kids selling water get the cops called on them.
That's the direction we need to go. Less freedom, less opportunity. You know, it's the minimum wage, like so many things that the left does, it's so blatantly, obviously indicative of their indifference to the people that they claim to care about. You know, they claim to care about the poor. They claim to care about people who are trying to scrape by on minimum wage jobs. And yet their prescribed solution doesn't change anything for those people. Certainly not in a positive. It actually does change something for them, but none of it's positive. What it does is it makes it more difficult for them to get the lousy job that they already have, for them to maintain the lousy job that they already have. It lessens opportunities for future people in similar circumstances to be able to get any kind of job whatsoever. It prevents children and people with low skills who are trying to make their way into the workforce, you know, teenagers who are getting their first jobs. It lessens their opportunities to be able to go out and do something and make a little bit of money on the side. You know, and that's the thing that the rhetoric surrounding the minimum wage just completely ignores. You always hear the politicians talk about it in terms of, well, you can't sustain a family on, you know, $8 an hour or whatever it is people are making, right? There's no way. You can't possibly pay the rent. You know, and they'll go down, they'll break it down. Here's what the rent is in St. Paul. Here's what it costs in order to be able to feed a family of four. You know, you can't possibly do that on the amount of money that people are paying. Who ever said, and where is it written in any sort of implied or actual law, that the purpose of having a minimum wage job is to feed a family of four, right? Like, there's all sorts of circumstances, like a teenager who still lives with their parents, a young adult who has one or more roommates and is sharing living expenses. There's a whole spectrum of circumstances where making that amount of money makes sense. And you know why I know that? You know why that's completely beyond dispute? Because people have those jobs. They voluntarily looked at, they knew, they walked into the interview and they sat down across from somebody who was looking to hire someone. And the decision maker, the person hiring, the manager said, hey, this is what the job entails. You're going to do this from this time to this time on these days of the week, and we're going to pay you this much to do it. And the prospective employee took a look at that arrangement and said, that makes a lot of sense. That's going to work with my schedule. That's going to leave me better off than I was without a job. That sounds like a good idea. Sign me up. I'm actually going to get out of bed by myself and bring myself here tomorrow to start enthusiastically. That's how I know that this had value, that these jobs have value, and that there are circumstances where these jobs make sense. And all you're doing by increasing the minimum wage is telling people that they don't get to have those opportunities, that the circumstances where those opportunities make sense are, they're just going to have to suffer through them and not have an option. Because it's not like you're replacing it with something that they can do. You're just taking it off the table. And that's evil. It's not just like an economic foul. That's morally reprehensible. Melvin Carter and those who are supporting this move in St. Paul are despicable human beings for taking away opportunities from people who don't have many. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name's Walter Edson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. I don't have the inside track on how the money works here at iHeartMedia, but I have a sneaking suspicion that this show potentially would not exist if our studios were located in either Minneapolis or St. Paul.
I would agree.
Because, you know, without getting too deep into it, the fact of the matter is this show makes sense for iHeart over having syndication for two reasons. One, our program director isn't a huge fan of syndication. Wants to have some local programming, which, you know, is a good thing. You want to be able to talk about Minneapolis, want to be able to talk about St. Paul and the Twin Cities area. But number two, financially, it's cheaper. It's cheaper to hire local guys. Now, if all of a sudden the state came along or the city came along and said, no, you got to pay these guys more, well then, you know, Brad and I are out of jobs and you're out of a show. And, you know, you've got less value for a higher price. And that type of dynamic would be in play at businesses and in economic transactions throughout the jurisdiction, whether we're talking about statewide or we're talking about a municipality. And there's nothing positive about that. Nobody wins in that scenario. It's like the tariff situation. Nobody wins when you artificially increase prices.
Well, I mean, you don't have to play a tiny violin for us or anything. Like,
no.
To me, like, I'm not going to be that much worse off if I don't have this radio show. But, like, the opportunity cost to take in this show is high for, I think, both me and Walter.
Right.
I could be pursuing other opportunities. Walter has a family.
Yeah.
But the value that we have in radio, and I hope the value that you get out of the show, is worth more than what I'm paid right. to me.
If it wasn't, we wouldn't show up.
Right.
Believe me. Believe me. The temptation to have my evenings back is strong. I feel that pull. But there's value in what we do here. But that equation by which I come to the conclusion of it makes sense could be thrown askew by government manipulation. Let's talk to John in Minneapolis. Welcome to the program.
Hi there. I just had a comment and then a question. I'm going to hang up and get your thoughts. My comment is about the minimum wage. It seems to me that most of the people who are squawking about minimum wage at $15 from what you see on TV is fast food workers. And my question is, when does it stop? I mean, we give them $15 an hour. Who's to say 5 years from now they're going to want 20 or 25, and who's going to pay for it? Thanks for your time.
Yep. The answers to those questions are absolutely, of course, they're going to ask for more, and two, you and I are going to pay for it. That respectively, those are the answers. And look, again, don't play tiny violins for we consumers who are going to pay more for our Big Macs and our Whoppers 5 or 10 years from now. The real losers, again, are the potential prospective employees who will not have opportunities to gain remedial skills that they can then parlay into other opportunities in the future. We're going to be cutting off those bottom rungs of the ladder. And I don't know how Melvin Carter, the mayor of St. Paul, and other lefties who think this is a great idea, I don't know what their vision is for how career development is going to work in the future, right? Like, what's the plan? Is it you're gonna be a K through 12 student who never gets a job, never works in the real world? Then we're going to send you to college under the Cortez plan. We're going to give you free college. We're going to send you there and rack up a bunch of debt, national debt for that. And then once you're done having your head stuffed full of progressive propaganda for the first 24 years of your life, we're going to spit you out into the world and expect you to be worth, you know, $60,000, $70,000 at a cubicle somewhere in some corporation that's getting taxed to death because it's a corporation. Like, that's their plan?
Melvin Carter's giving every student in St. Paul a $50 scholarship.
Oh, well, I take it all back. That's genius. Another city that is dead set on killing itself economically is Mountain View, California. From the Star Tribune, voters in Google's Silicon Valley hometown will decide whether the search engine leader and other tech companies should pay or should help pay for the traffic congestion and other headaches resulting from mushrooming workforces. The city council in Mountain View, California voted Tuesday to place a measure on the November ballot asking residents to authorize taxing businesses between $9 and $149 per employee. The Mercury News in San Jose, California reports Wednesday. The move comes weeks after Seattle leaders succumbed to strident opposition from online retailer Amazon and repealed a tax on large companies aimed at alleviating homelessness. Why does anybody do business in California? I don't understand. Why even bother? This is just absolutely not. So, you know, as somebody who serves on a city council, this story perplexes me to no end. The idea that you want Google to pay an extra tax supposedly to help with traffic congestion. Okay, so the property taxes that they pay, which are no doubt expansive, I'm sure they're a huge percentage, like a huge chunk of the revenue that the city of Mountain View takes in are the property taxes that come from Google. That's not enough to add a lane to your road or to maintain the concrete. Like, that's not enough to keep your infrastructure intact. I have a sneaking suspicion that if we actually went through the budgetary line items out there in Mountain View, California, there might be a few things above and beyond roads and bridges, above and beyond sewer and water, that's actually the real issue here. And just like over in Seattle, where they tried to tax Amazon in order to provide for the homeless. There might be a little bit of social engineering taking place over there in Silicon Valley. Let's talk to Sue in St. Paul. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I hate to do this. I'd much rather argue, you know, but when you were talking about you felt the pull of wanting to be home at night, that worries me because you do provide value to us. You know, you make us think differently. I know that's what you like to do is make people think, and you do. And I look forward to your show, and you're one of my favorites now. So stick with it, please. Maybe your pay will go up.
Well, I very much appreciate the call and appreciate the encouragement. And yeah, maybe my pay will go up. Powers that be, I heart gods, maybe it will. Sue says so. From Sue's lips to God's ears.
I mean, I appreciate her earnestness.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think we'll cut to break a little bit early here. I want to come back and talk about, you know, there's a piece over here at Breitbart that speculates that Kathleen Kennedy, who is the current president and head of Lucasfilm, is being targeted for firing in the wake of the financial disappointment and indeed failure of Solo, A Star Wars Story. And, you know, I'm a big Star Wars fan, as longtime listeners to the program are aware. And the watching the decline and the implosion of that franchise is something that, you know, it's sad, but at the same time, it's also affirming because the thing is collapsing for reasons. It's collapsing for reasons that are indicative of the things we talk about here every day in terms of the culture war and the injection of politics into literally everything that you can't escape from. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. So when the news was announced some years ago now that Disney was purchasing Lucasfilm from George Lucas and that they were going to start producing new Star Wars films, starting with a sequel trilogy interspersed with standalone stories, you know, back in those early days, they referred to them as anthology films that were going to supposedly expand the narrative beyond the Skywalker saga to make the universe bigger. I was excited. You know, there are a lot of people who are skeptical about what Disney would do and whether or not a Disney Star Wars film or series of films would in fact still be Star Wars, or whether they would Disney-fy it, or, you know, make it kid friendly and not be true to the original nature of it. But I had a lot of hope because I saw only the potential. On the potential of what could be done. And when they started to talk about, you know, their approach to it, you know, there were a lot of encouraging comments. Kathleen Kennedy, the president of Lucasfilm under Disney, who herself has a great pedigree in terms of the film she's worked on in the past. She's worked with George Lucas. She's worked with Steven Spielberg. You know, you see her name in the credits of iconic blockbuster films from the past, the Indiana Jones series, you know, everything Spielberg's ever done, right? Back to the Future and what have you. So, you know, it was ostensibly the franchise is in good hands, and she was making good comments. She was talking about the value of these characters, the importance of staying true to them, the responsibility to the fans, you know, all the things that you should say. And then they announced that they were going to have this story group, which is this core group of editors and writers who are going to be keeping all of the canon in sync so that the films and the comics and the new animated series and all these things actually fitted in one integral whole and told an overarching narrative. And that was exciting because it's like, you know, it's kind of like having a television show where there's an ongoing story being told from a variety of different perspectives. And then we ended up getting these films. And it's just been, a bizarre experience in a variety of ways. And I've been in, as Brad can attest, I've been in denial regarding the downfall of Star Wars.
Yes, you have. You defended the last one.
Yes, I did. And I stand by my defense in the context in which I defended it, which was with a number of presumptions. I presumed that this story group was in fact doing what it was advertised to do, which is telling an overall coherent story, that they had a plan, much like the Marvel films where they have, you know, the different phases and they know the direction that the overall franchise is going, and they make sure that each writer and each director, you know, tells their episode of the tale in a manner that's consistent with what came before and the direction they're planning to go in the future. I assumed that it was all going to eventually make sense. And then it started to become clear as controversy and comments and revelations started to emerge that, in fact, there is no plan. There basically is no plan, that it's all a joke, that it's like a relay race. That one director, that J.J. Abrams, you know, he made The Force Awakens, and then he passed the baton to Rian Johnson, and Rian Johnson basically had carte blanche to do whatever he wanted, to just write whatever. And that's exactly what he did. He went out and he wrote whatever. And he did so, apparently, in concert with Kathleen Kennedy, trying to promote a particular social and political agenda from Breitbart. The left-leaning trades Deadline, The Hollywood Reporter, and Variety continue to willfully drop the ball when it comes to intelligent and honest reporting on Disney's imploding Star Wars franchise. This means their readers cannot trust them for accurate and objective information. If a single one of these outlets had shown the moral courage to accurately report on the fan revolt against the left-wing turn the franchise has taken with Kennedy at the wheel, I missed it. And Kennedy's politics are the whole enchilada. The primary reason the most loyal fans in fandom are in full rebellion, and why The Last Jedi is now seen as the Batman versus Superman of the Star Wars universe, meaning the movie that was still a hit but soured everyone on the franchise. The Solo film is bottomed out at $203 million domestically and a devastating $354 million worldwide. Just to put that into context, The Last Jedi was a $1 billion film. $1 billion. And Solo made less than a third of that. And it lost money. $80 million by some estimate. Reporting on this massive story, it's clear that their personal politics and their desire to suck up to all things Disney has resulted in wish casting instead of journalism, as they intentionally ignore the real reason behind the implosion of the most iconic franchise in Hollywood history. And so, because we know the trades are compromised and dishonest, we are forced to look for reporting in the alternative media, which is where we learned things are so bad at Lucasfilm, the standalone features, once in active development, are now on hold or canceled. Either way, that report is almost a week old, and Disney has not uttered a single word of pushback. On the heels of that report comes the news that Disney is freaking out over the mind-boggling failure of Solo, a failure made all the more terrifying by that pathetic worldwide, and now Kathleen Kennedy's job is on the line. According to Randolph, Disney chief Bob Iger held a super-secret conference call with all the hotshots at Lucasfilm. Guards were posted at the doors to prevent leaks. Also on the call were the big shots from Pixar and Marvel. During the call, Iger reportedly admitted he wants to dump Kennedy, but is stuck with her for two reasons. One, half of the Lucasfilm division is loyal to her, and two, no one wants the job. J.J. Abrams, who directed The Force Awakens in the upcoming Episode 9, turned the job down flat. Apparently, no one wants to deal with Kennedy's hardcore loyalists, and no one wants to take the wheel of the Titanic. Randolph also reports that Disney is fully aware of the real problem. Kennedy was never a Star Wars fan. She resented that it was targeted at boys and decided to blow up what worked, which she hated, and remake the franchise into a politicized female empowerment vehicle aimed at social justice.
Told warriors.
Ya. Now, again, yeah, Brad's absolutely right to gloat, because this is something that I denied when I came out of The Last Awakens, that that's not what they're trying to do. This isn't about social justice. This isn't about, you know, female empowerment, what have you. I'm coming around into accepting the emergent clear fact that that is in fact the agenda, informed by a few things. First and foremost, what Kathleen Kennedy has actually said, what Rian Johnson, the director of Last Jedi, has actually said, their unbridled, unmasked, unveiled disdain and contempt for their own fans who don't like the direction this franchise is going. You know, calling their own fans racist and misogynist, you know, and not taking any responsibility for the fact that their stories don't make any sense at all. Their stories don't have any continuity, that there is no plan. You know, because that's the thing is, it goes beyond just this. Like, I could forgive the social justice stuff. I really could. Social justice stuff has been infused into movies. You know, I mean, go back to the original Star Wars, 1977. What was Princess Leia, if not a social statement on female empowerment, right? But you didn't care. Nobody cared because she was a compelling character who had a compelling story to tell. And her actions and her words and her deeds made sense within the context of the narrative that was being displayed on screen. You know, we've had there. I watched a YouTube video recently of a guy who was trying to make this point about strong female characters. He's like, and he just played a bunch of clips going throughout film history of all the strong female characters from genre films like Sarah Connor, Terminator 2, right? Ellen Ripley, Aliens. You know, go down the list, The Matrix, Trinity, that never caused this kind of controversy. You know, never had fans being like, oh, I don't like women in my movies. Like, that's never been a thing. It's only ever been, tell me a story that's interesting and that makes some kind of narrative sense. And that's where Kathleen Kennedy and Lucasfilm have dropped the ball. And it's deeply unfortunate. I don't know how they're going to pull out of it, if at all. J.J. Abrams doesn't seem particularly interested in standing up for the roots of the franchise here. So I'm ambivalent, which is saying something after a lifetime of being a fan of a franchise. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Glenn Beck is next. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.